name's Jack Jericho. Has anyone ever told you that you have the face of a bolt of jelly and the body of a digger?
No one who wasn't trying to pick me up.
What's that? How kind, really. God, I love the way you said that. Hi. Did anyone ever tell you that you have the face of a Botticelli in the body of a Degas?
I'm a 10th grade art teacher.
Look, I must run, but let me assure you, this is only the beginning.
The trailer for James Toback's 1987 film, The Pickup Artist, sounds a lot different now, given real-life events. 38 women have come forward so far, accusing James Toback of sexual harassment and strange sexual assaults. Many report that Toback first approached them in public in New York, promising entree to the movie business. KCRW reporter Anna Scott, who was then a high school senior in New York, had an experience just like that. She's here. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Also, Glenn Whipp is here. He broke the story for the LA Times. Welcome.
Hello.
Glenn, let's begin with you. He targeted young women, Toback did, usually in college or high school even. What was his MO?
You know, he walked around the streets of Manhattan and he would introduce himself as a film director. He'd mentioned who he'd worked with. Robert Downey Jr. was always a name, or often a name, that he would mention as a ally, a close friend, somebody who he had created his career. Often he'd direct a woman to go around the corner to a Barnes & Noble with him to show him a book. So just to establish his credentials. And then at some point, he'd ask them if they were interested in acting. He had probably a part in his next movie that would be perfect for them. He'd like to work with them to help him create this role for them, but he'd need to get to know them well and intimately. I think Anna can share.
Yeah, so Anna, you were 18, and he approached you on the street?
Yeah, and it's exactly what Glenn is describing. It was one of my last days of high school, which I remember because I was at school just to take a test. I didn't have to be there for a whole day. I had this break in between tests, and I had gone to a deli across the street to get a water or something. And this man comes up to me. I didn't know who he was, but he introduces himself as James Toback, a director and writer. And he lists off his resume. He did mention Robert Downey Jr. almost right away. I mean, yeah. It's funny, but it's not funny. And he said he was working on a new movie called Black and White, and that Mike Tyson was scheduled to be in the movie, and that he was trying to cast the rest of it with unknowns from in and around New York City. And that I just looked interesting to him, and that he wanted to know if I had any interest in maybe being a part of this movie. So I was a teenager. I thought being in a movie sounded cool. I was also scheduled to attend USC the following fall, and my major in school was going to be screenwriting. So I thought this was a lucky connection.
And you had never heard of him before?
No, I hadn't. And I wasn't a completely naive 18-year-old either. He told me that he was going to be on the Charlie Rose show later that day, and that I should come to the taping, sit in on it, and then afterwards he talked to me about this movie. And I thought that sounded legit. So he said if I wanted to do that, I should meet him on the street corner in a few hours, and we'd go over to Charlie Rose and I'd hear more about it. So I did my homework. I called the Charlie Rose show and made sure that, in fact, somebody named James Toback was going to be on. I confirmed that he was who he said he was, took a physics final, and then I went and I met him on the street corner and proceeded to have this few-hour, afternoon-long odyssey of exactly what Glenn describes. I went to the Charlie Rose show. I watched him be interviewed. Then we walked around the streets of Midtown Manhattan, and he told me more about this movie that he had in mind and what it was. And gradually along the way, he began asking me really inappropriate sexual questions and telling me inappropriate sexual things. He told me how many times a day he likes to masturbate and how it was this important thing for him to clear his head. He asked me if I masturbated, and if so, how often. He asked me to describe to him my hair on my body and, you know, how much of it there was or wasn't, and told me that in his experience, the most interesting women in the world are about a 7 or 8 on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of body hair.
So at this point, you're thinking, who's this creep?
Yes. And it's humiliating to be talked to in this way. And it's embarrassing now to even recount it. When I was that age, you know, I was somewhat savvy, but didn't have a ton of experience. And so it just kind of got gradually more and more uncomfortable.
And then did you feel like it was too hard to extricate yourself from the situation?
Yeah, which, of course, in retrospect, as a an adult now, you know, I think to myself, my God, obviously I could have just turned around at any point and walked away, which I did eventually do. But he has this way of saying these things in a very matter-of-fact tone so that there's a little piece of my mind that thought, well, maybe this is just how
maybe
he works.
Maybe this is how Hollywood works.
Right. Maybe this is what Hollywood people are like. Before I finally did leave, I was thinking, well, how can I calmly leave the scene and not offend anyone here?
And Glenn, is this something that you heard from the other women you interviewed?
Yes. I mean, there was a distinct pattern. You know, it published Sunday morning, and since then, I have heard from so many more women. I mean, mid-afternoon yesterday, it was at least double the number that I had interviewed for the story.
Wow. And so 80 at least.
Yeah. And I'd like to err on the side of just being conservative in saying the number, but it's countless.
It was kind of an open secret. I mean, since it's a Wikipedia page that he used to do this kind of stuff. There was a Spy magazine article written about him in the 1980s, after all. Were there any criminal charges ever filed, or was the police ever brought in? Was there anything actionable from a legal perspective, from a police perspective?
I mean, there would be plenty of things actionable at the time, but no one filed reports. Mm. The Spy magazine article that ran in 1989 used first names only, and I think may well have just been pseudonyms and not actual first names. It was a very glib sort of, here's this creepy pickup artist going around the streets of New York propositioning women. But, you know, it didn't really get into the sexual...
The serious nature of it.
Yeah, the serious nature of it, sure.
And Anna, so you ended up that day having dinner with him. So what happened at this dinner?
Part of a dinner. So we were walking around the streets of Midtown. At this point, I was feeling really uncomfortable and definitely had the idea that this guy probably didn't want to put me in a movie, that he actually had ulterior motives and I should just extricate myself. But we reached a certain point where he said, oh, hey, just step into this restaurant with me. I'm meeting my friend for dinner. Just come in and, you know, and meet my friend. So I go into this restaurant with him, and the friend that he's meeting is actually a very famous director, Barry Levinson.
Who did Diner.
Good Morning Vietnam.
Bugsy.
Well, he directed Bugsy, which Toback wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So we go into this restaurant where we sit down at a table where Toback joins Barry Levinson, who is already there. Toback introduces us and pretty much continues the conversation with me as it had been on the street, just as invasive and inappropriate, but in front of this very prominent director. And
you knew who Barry Levinson was at the time.
I knew who he was. He didn't say anything through the course of this, so who knows what he was thinking. I have no idea. I don't know what their relationship is or was. But didn't say anything, just sat there very stoically as Toback continued his spiel. And I was incredibly embarrassed at this point. I mean, at the time, I did know who Barry Levinson was. I definitely had the idea that Toback didn't want to put me in a movie, and I was thinking, oh, great. Now here I am looking like a complete idiot in front of Barry Levinson, who just thinks I'm some foolish teenager that has fallen for this line of Toback's, and here I am with him. I mean, I just wanted to crawl into a hole and die at that point. So,
did you ever feel unsafe?
I wouldn't say I felt unsafe in any physical way or anything like that, because I just stayed in, I was in public places with him this whole afternoon. And it was finally, not long into that dinner, that one of the many things that Toback said to me was, okay, so the next step of this process, if you want to continue this, is that we would have to meet somewhere private. We'd have to go to a hotel, something like a hotel room, and then I'd continue to ask you questions and we get to know each other better. And it was around then that I finally just abruptly stood up and I said something like, I'm sorry, this is just too weird for me, and I fled out the door. That was it. But I know there are other women, I learned after reading Glenn's article, who had much more traumatic experiences with him.
Glenn, what were some of those experiences?
Well, I mean, there were some meetings where he told people that he was editing a movie and come to the editing suite, and he had an office in the editing suite. And there are other ones where it was in Central Park, at least one, and there were others in hotel rooms. And he had a way of convincing women that part of the process, get over your don't be prudish, get over your hang-ups. How could you expect to be in a movie that's pushing the envelope but not be intimate with me here? And So if you were truly unfortunate, these encounters ended with him approaching you, kneeling before you, and starting to dry hump your leg and grind against it, often to sexual release.
Mm. But what you described, this whole don't be prudish, this is how it works in the business, this sounds like what Harvey Weinstein would tell some of the women who came, who, you know, he was trying to convince to do things. And so when you're looking at this story in conjunction with the Harvey Weinstein story and some of the other stories we're hearing, do you see a pattern?
Yes. And there's a pattern. And I've received a lot of emails from people saying it was a pattern in their, on a show they worked on or on an audition they went on.
With other men.
I think one thing that Anna mentioned in that restaurant encounter that struck me, we don't know what Barry Levinson was thinking, and he may well have been disgusted, but he didn't say anything. And that's important, because just not only in the entertainment industry, but in any workplace, if men see this kind of behavior happening, they need to say something.
Right, and not think that this is just the way it works.
Exactly.
Which is the way it has worked.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And in retrospect, looking back on that, I mean, I think of how embarrassed I was in the moment and where my head was at. And now I think, what was going on there? You know, why didn't Barry Levinson say anything? I don't know. But
well, also that your reaction was, I'm the stupid, naive teenager who made the mistake, rather than blaming Toback Levinson, that you took the blame on yourself.
Yeah. I think that's something that a lot of women internalize. And I hope that with these stories coming out and more people talking about these kinds of experiences, that starts to go away.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, being public with it.
You're welcome.
That's Anna Scott. She's a producer and a reporter here at KCRW. Glenn Whipp, thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn Whipp, you can read his reporting on this story at the Los Angeles Times. We've asked Barry Levinson for comment on Toback and Anna's dinner meeting. We have not heard back yet, and James Toback has denied all the allegations against him. Coming up, whatever happened to that lawsuit accusing President Trump of illegally taking payments from foreign governments? We'll have an update next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember the Emoluments Clause? We learned all about that early on in the Trump administration. It's that obscure provision in the Constitution that bars elected officials from accepting payments or things of value from foreign governments. And there was lots of discussion about whether President Trump violated that clause. There was also a big lawsuit filed. Well, late last week, a federal judge in Manhattan heard arguments on whether to let that case move forward. Among the more bizarre hypotheticals posed by the judge was this question: would $1 million worth of hot dogs violate the Emoluments Clause? Jessica Levinson is here to talk about that. She's law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday Legal Eagle. Hello.
And your hot dog expert.
I know. Well, tell us, what was that about, that question?
So there are a couple of issues that came out during the oral arguments, and one of them was not necessarily about barbecue meat, but was about what is an emolument. And so what the plaintiffs, those who are bringing the suit, who are saying that President Trump has violated the clause, they said it's anything of value. And the Department of Justice, obviously the government who's defending President Trump, said, no, it really has to be a quid pro quo. It's more like bribery. So the judge and the attorney for the Department of Justice went round and round. And basically, the judge said, OK, if you own a hot dog stand and I say I'm going to give you $1 million and you sign a treaty, if I buy $1 million of hot dogs, even if you don't sign the treaty, come on, this is what falls within emolument. Right. And finally, the Department of Justice attorney was like, OK, yes, you're right. So there was, as I said, a couple of interesting things came out of the oral arguments, but one of them was this disagreement about what an emolument is. And that's because we have no law on this issue because
this has never happened before.
Most presidents don't find themselves in a situation where there are suits against them based on the emoluments clause.
Okay. One of the things that they need to figure out, right, is whether or not the plaintiff actually has what's known as standing, was actually damaged by whatever they're accusing President Trump of doing. And was that resolved?
No, that was not resolved. So this is a case that's now on a motion to dismiss. So the argument wasn't about who wins or who loses. The argument is, can plaintiffs go forward? And frankly, that's kind of the name of the game here, because mm-hmm. if plaintiffs can continue, it means they can ask for evidence. And that evidence would be, for instance, tax returns and financial records. And so even if they don't ultimately think they can win the case, a win for them would be we get to keep going in this case. So a motion to dismiss is an argument that plaintiffs, based on what you said in the complaint, there's no possible way that you could win. And so the threshold question for the plaintiffs, as you said, concerns standing. And it's really, are you plaintiffs hurt enough? Do you have a specific and particularized injury? And the argument is that this is a group of people who, among others, are hotel workers and restaurant owners, and that they used to get business, but now all the business is going to the Trump organization because all the foreign diplomats and others want to curry favor with Trump.
And when will that be decided? Do we know?
Well, no, I think that it will be everybody's least favorite answer. I think it will be soon, but judge can take as long as he wants.
Okay. Okay, let's move on to this other story, the really fascinating story brought by ProPublica. And this was about whether or not the Supreme Court sometimes relies on erroneous information when making these very important decisions. And in the story, one of the examples cited involved NASA employees who sued NASA over having to submit to background checks. And then there was a statistic cited by one of the justices that turned out to be false.
Yeah, that's right. And this is like one of those things where you find out like, oh, my goodness, my parents cry and, you know, there is no Santa Claus and Supreme Court justices make mistakes.
They're human.
Yeah. And even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, whose workout routine is just
superhuman, unbelievable.
So the lawsuit involved was in the wake of 9/11, and they were trying to tighten security with respect to outside employees who did work for NASA. And they said, you should be subject to background checks like federal employees. And Justice Samuel Alito cited a statistic that said, well, in 88% of private companies, employees are subject to these type of background checks. So stop complaining. It's OK. As it turns out, that statistic doesn't have any basis, let's say. And so this is something that is happening in the Supreme Court, in part because they're just getting more information from more sources. So I think in this NASA case, the statistic was from something called an amicus brief, which is basically a friend of the court brief. It's not from either party. And so the errors,
but with someone who has an agenda, someone who has a point of view.
Exactly. Well, everybody who comes to the Supreme Court has an agenda. So it's not a
but
neutral
it's not an
party.
Unbiased fact, in other words.
Right. It's a friend of the court who either wants the plaintiff to win or wants the defendant to win. And what we're seeing here is that the justices are making their own mistakes when it comes to their own research, or they're relying on either amicus briefs or briefs from the parties where there's a statistic or there's a piece of information that's cited and it's either wrong or there's just nothing behind it to back that up. And so we've seen errors with respect to voter registration, with respect to how often those accused of sexual crimes actually commit sexual crimes, how often they recommit, how often the United States sends back people who were mistakenly deported. So really important things. And even if these didn't ultimately change the outcome of the case, it becomes something that we all believe because the Supreme Court said it.
But do you think that it may have changed the outcome of these cases?
You know, it's hard to say, but in the examples we talked about, it sounds pivotal. It sounds really important. Now,
well, especially with the sex offender case. And in that situation, they relied on a simply erroneous recidivism fact, right? That
exactly.
Sexual offenders are much more prone to reoffend than other criminals, which is not true.
And which is something, by the way, now I hear all the time,
right.
Like it's just, let's take it as fact. And I think that's in part because it was in the Supreme Court opinion. Now, whether or not it changed the outcome is something, you know, we would have to be in conference with the mm-hmm. Supreme Court justices to know. But it certainly would make their arguments weaker if they didn't have these statistics to back them up. And so Supreme Court justices, like the rest of us, they make mistakes. And it's very difficult for every statistic or every fact that's ever cited in a Supreme Court brief for there to be someone who goes through and checks what is your actual sourcing for this. And that's what we're seeing here. That's why there are proposals to say the Supreme Court should have its own research arm.
Finally, this is kind of fun.
This is super fun.
The latest justice, the newest justice, Neil Gorsuch, he's not playing well with others.
So we just talked about, well, we can't be in the conference, which is when the Supreme Court justices, after oral arguments, kind of sit around a table. There's a closed door and they say what they really think about a case. And that is supposed to be secret, as is what you really think about your colleagues. But it looks like there is... It looks like Neil Gorsuch is not making friends on the Supreme Court.
And how is he annoying his colleagues?
Well, I think it sounds like it's in part verbally and in part in written form. And so I think in oral arguments, we've seen him do something that junior justices usually don't do, which is come out really strong, really sarcastic, and frankly, without any modesty or humility. So he said something in a recent oral argument like, could we please get back to the arcane issue of the Constitution? That's just really slapping your colleagues in the face and saying, what you're doing is a sideshow and I'm the one here who's concerned about the Constitution.
Isn't that their entire job?
It is in fact their entire job. The question is, will he be so kind of repugnant that he turns off his colleagues? Because the most important thing is in the Supreme Court, you have to count to five. If he can't get four friends, he's not going to be an effective justice.
Jessica Levinson, you can count to five, I think, and maybe a little higher. Law professor at Loyola Law School, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, author Jesmyn Ward is here to talk about her new novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing.
I specifically wanted to use the word unburied because I also wanted to reference the living, too.
Ward talks about the ghosts that haunt the present and how America cannot escape its slave-owning past. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, a modern William Faulkner. That's the comparison made in nearly every conversation about author Jesmyn Ward. Just like the famed American writer and Nobel laureate, Ward sets her novels in a fictional town in Mississippi. That's her home state. And she builds her stories around race. It's a painful place in both Southern and American history and how it continues the burden in the present. Ward's latest novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing, is no exception. The book is written primarily from the perspective of a mom and her biracial teenage son who are haunted by ghosts from the family's past. Sing is already on the short list for this year's National Book Award, an award Jesmyn Ward has already won for her 2011 novel, Salvage the Bones. And her writing has also earned her a MacArthur Genius Grant. Jesmyn Ward joins us now. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
So many accolades.
Yes.
your head must be spinning in a way.
It is. I don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on. It's totally disorienting.
Well, let's just dive right in then to the novel. And that is something that I'm sure is not disorienting for you. And let's talk about Jojo, one of your mm-hmm. characters, and the most sympathetic voice. He's a 13-year-old boy. His dad is white and in prison for dealing drugs. His mother is black. She's addicted to drugs, and she's pretty much absent and not parenting him. So he looks up to his grandparents, who are raising him and his younger sister. Where did this character come from?
I don't No. I discovered his character after I completed the first rough draft of Salvage the Bones. And so I was anxious, right? And so I wanted to immediately begin working on a new novel. And so I was like casting about for ideas, and then Jojo popped into my head. And so the question that popped into my head along with Jojo was, what would it be like for a 13-year-old mixed race boy growing up in the modern South? He was present in that question, and that question was like the seed for Sing, Unburied, Sing.
So does Jojo acknowledge his white side at all? Does he think of himself as biracial, or does he think of himself as black?
I mean, I think he acknowledges that he's, you know, that he's biracial and that half of his extended family is white. But I think that the life that he leads, you know, makes him think about himself as a black boy.
And certainly he's seen in one particular scene as a black boy. And I'm talking about the scene where the family's in a car and they've just gone to pick up the dad from prison and he's just been released and they're driving home. And they're pulled over by a police officer, mm-hmm. and the police officer pulls a gun on Jojo. And did you think of that scene when you were thinking about what's been happening in America in real life with police officers and black men?
I think so. I mean, you know, as soon as I knew, and I knew from the very beginning that Jojo and his family, you know, were going on a road trip, and that they were heading into, you know, central and northern Mississippi, you know, to Parchman Prison. And so because I knew from the beginning that they were going on a road trip, I pretty much figured that they were going to get pulled over, and that would not be a good thing, really, for any of the characters, but especially for Jojo. You know, especially in light of what we've seen happen again and again, right? Mm-hmm. you know, in America.
So they're on the way to pick up his dad, who's been released from Parchman Prison, which is a real prison, right, in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And this basically, from the 40s on, trapped generations of black men and forced them into labor, often for minor offenses. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's basically the root of all your characters' pain in this novel. It's where the dad, Michael, is imprisoned, as we said. It's where the family's headed on this horrible road trip. And it's where Jojo's grandfather spent some time, and where he had a friend, or he took under his wing another young boy who was incarcerated there named Richie, who ends up in your novel. He's a ghost. And I wonder if you could talk about this place, Parchman, as the locus for all of this pain.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting to talk about Parchman with people who, you know, are not from the South or who may not be familiar with Mississippi or Mississippi history, because when I was growing up in Mississippi, I knew about Parchman Prison. All of us knew about Parchman Prison, especially black children. We all knew about Parchman Prison. You know, we may not have known like the exact history of the place, but it looms really large in the public imagination, in Mississippi, especially among like black Mississippians. I think because, you know, that it was that people, when they were brought there in the 40s, I mean, they were basically enslaved again. right? Mm-hmm. In the 30s and the 40s, they were enslaved again. Not only did they work in the fields at Parchman Prison Farm, which is basically a plantation, but they were also, the prison, those in charge in the prison would actually rent the prisoners out to industrial barons in the region to complete projects. And they had no choice in the matter. You know, so basically they were enslaved again. And I think that that knowledge is what creates the menace.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jesmyne Ward. She's the author of the new book, Sing, Unburied, Sing. It's her first novel since winning the National Book Award in 2011. And Sing, too, is on the shortlist for this year's National Book Award. And the title of your novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing, you're talking about the ghosts, the two ghosts that are in this novel?
I'm talking about the ghosts, but I specifically wanted to use the word unburied because I also wanted to reference the living, too.
Hmm. But I guess it implies a kind of, I don't know, a dread if you're referring to the living when you call them unburied.
Yeah. Yes. But I think that, you know, one of the things that the characters in this book learn or that they realize is that, you know, that death is the thing that we do not escape. You know, it's always present.
Let's talk about the other ghost. We mentioned Richie, but let's talk about Given, who is the brother of Leonie, who's the mother of Jojo. And Leonie, not a sympathetic character per se. She's selfish, addicted to drugs, a really bad mom to her two children. And yet you feel for her, you have empathy for her, especially in the scenes where Given visits her and her brother, who was murdered by the cousin of Michael, the man that she's in love with, and the father of Jojo. And so tell us more about who Given is for you.
Discovering Given's character really opened up my understanding of Leonie. You know, I think they had a very close sibling relationship. And I also think that he made Leonie look beyond herself in a way that, you know, that she didn't really do with her mother or her father, because she cared about him and because she expressed that care for him. So I think that he made her less selfish. And, you know, for all those reasons, I think that his death is like this great wound for her. You know, it marks her. And I think that because she can't face it and because she can't live with it, you know, she runs from it.
Is Given based at all on your life, on the fact that you lost your brother to a drunk driving accident when he was young?
You know, I was hesitant to write Given into Sing, Unburied, Sing because of my brother. You know, I didn't want readers to confuse, you know, me and my grief with Leonie and her grief. And so I was nervous. And I think that in the end, it worked, because their relationship is very different from the one that I had with my brother. You know, the grief that she carries and the guilt that she carries is very different from the grief and the guilt that I, you know, that I feel for my own brother.
So given that you set this in the present day in Mississippi, and we've been having a lot of conversations about race in the recent months and around Charlottesville and Confederate monuments and police shootings and taking knees at NFL games and all that kind of stuff, very important stuff. What do you see in Mississippi's future and in the South's future when it comes to this?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like part of the work that I am attempting to do in, you know, in my fiction and in my creative nonfiction is I'm trying to be part of a conversation about the ways that that people of African descent have been seen as worthless, you know, in this country. From the founding of this country onward. And, you know, what makes it so frustrating for me to live in Mississippi is that it seems like, especially in Mississippi, people don't want to acknowledge that. You know, they want to separate slavery from the Civil War. They want to, you know, change our understanding of what slavery was and of how awful it was and of how it was founded on this idea that one group of people was worth less than another. And I feel like my work is trying to push back against that, right? And look at the ways that, you know, that history bears in the present.
And is that one reason why you decided to go back to Mississippi, where you grew up, to a small town? I mean, you got 2 degrees from Stanford. You got a degree from the University of Michigan. You probably could have lived anywhere if you wanted to. Is that one reason why you decided to go back, to sort of feel that past sort of more acutely?
Yes, I think that was part of it. You know, I went back because I missed my community. I missed my family. You know, I missed the beauty of this place. I missed all those things. But I also think that living here keeps me honest, you know, about the people that I write about the place that I write about. So, yeah, so I think that that's one of the reasons that I returned.
And you'll stay?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think the fact that I've had children changes the way that I think about home, you know, and the fear that I feel when I think about that, when I think about their futures, you know, when I think about what it's like to grow up in a place like this. I think that fear is making me rethink my commitment.
You're afraid for their personal safety.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my kids are growing up in a place where, yes, they'll learn, you know, they live with a, you know, with my family, with a large extended family. They'll have a real sense of community growing up in this place. But they're also growing up in a place, you know, where people have lived in poverty for generations. They're growing up in a place where, you know, the Black community has been like starved of resources, you know, where there are no resources. My kids can't even go down to the local park and play because there's, you know, there's nothing there. And whatever is there is like on the verge of falling down and perhaps injuring them. You know, I mean, they're growing up in a place where, you know, where the people in power will not invest in the infrastructure, right? The public infrastructure, the safety infrastructure for the community. So I don't know. I don't know if this is the best place for them.
When I asked you about safety, I was actually referring to being shot, but...
Oh, yeah. No, I meant to include that, too. You know, I mean, yeah, I meant to include that. That too. And not only like by police, right? I mean, Mississippi is an open carry state. So, I mean, you know, I mean, people are walking around with guns strapped to their hips. That scares me. I don't. If I want them to lead healthier and happier lives, I don't know if I'm making the best choices to make that happen.
Well, I want to thank you so much for another great conversation. I really liked it. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Author Jesmyn Ward, her new novel is called Sing, Unburied Sing. It's on the short list for this year's National Book Award. Coming up on this program, another great conversation with the Sklar Brothers. We're going to talk about the Dodgers next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
All right. great, pretty great time to be a sports fan in LA, unless you're a soccer fan, that is. The Galaxy, terrible. Lakers fans may be suffering through another long season. However, Rams and Chargers, they're doing okay. Clippers.
Yeah.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you, Melanie? There's another team, too.
What? Yeah, the Dodgers.
What are they called?
I think they're the Dodgers.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Sklar Brothers.
Oh, yeah, we are a comedy team in L.A. But the Dodgers are really the story of it all.
We have a World Series
right here.
I know. I was going to talk about this other stuff, but...
We can talk about the other stuff. By the way, Clippers off to a great start. I mean, Lakers, I know they're 1-2. Briefly, we'll just say Lonzo Ball had a kind of a inauspicious opening game against the Clippers where Patrick Beverley, who played for the Clippers,
basically shut him down
and embarrassed him and then afterwards talked trash about him. But that's going to happen. You know, LaVar Ball, his father, is a big trash talker. He's got a big target on him. Everybody wants to guard him. Everybody wants to make him look like a fool. So he's got that, but he's really a good kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of showed a little bounce back against Phoenix. Lakers have stuff to be excited about. There's a future out there. Clippers look good without Chris Paul. They actually look good. So that's good. The Kings have played 7 games and they haven't lost once. So sports, it's
good. What are the Chargers? There are Chargers now.
There are Chargers in L.A. and they lost their first 4 games and everyone thought, well, here, thanks, San Diego, have them back. But they've won 3 in a row and they beat the Denver Broncos this past weekend.
A really good Denver Broncos team.
Blanked them 21-0. And, you know, a lot of people were saying about the Chargers front for their defense, it's one of the best in the game. So what's amazing is that, you know, the Rams are 5-2.
Rams could be one of the best teams in the NFC. Like, the Rams will make the playoffs, I believe, right now.
Does anyone go to see these games?
Yeah.
Yeah, people are, and I think, you know, the better the team does, the more people will jump on that bandwagon.
The Rams have 2 great things. They've got Todd Gurley, who's one of the best running backs in the league, and they've got Jared Goff, who's one of the best young quarterbacks in the
league. And I'm going to add one more thing. They picked up Sammy Watkins, a wide receiver, who, when they say this, can lengthen the field. When he's a deep threat, if he's someone who can go down the field, then the other teams can't just crowd the line of scrimmage and play the run the whole
time. They have to respect this guy and his speed, which opens it up for Todd Gurley. They have a great coach, Sean McVay, great.
31 years old.
The guy knows what he's doing, and he is really putting a great plan in place for this team to win. So the Rams, Los Angeles got the Rams, and now they're good. It's kind of amazing how they're good so fast. It's really a good story for Los Angeles.
Okay, well, an even better story is the World Series.
Yeah.
And so that's starting tomorrow night at 5 o'clock. It's going to be about 1,000 degrees.
Yes. They said,
give
look,
or take a degree.
We want a World Series in a Bikram yoga studio.
And they got it.
Which, by the way, we remember, you can go back and watch Yankees World Series, the one that like dribbled into November. And we remember 1982 World Series, St. Louis Cardinals and the Milwaukee Brewers at the time. And it was freezing. People were wearing like coats and all bundled up.
Pitcher's breath before they pitched.
Yeah, it was freezing. Okay, 100 degrees actually works in players' favors, especially the injured players like Corey Seager, who's got tightness in his back. You know, for the Dodgers, this might be the thing he needs to sort of.
The Dodgers are optimistic. They're saying
so
that
he will
play. So
it'll loosen them up. Their muscles will be all ready.
Pitchers as well. I think if you're throwing really hard in cold temperatures, there's a chance that you could get injured. Whereas if you're throwing in intense heat, it actually loosens up your arm a little bit more. So that's a good thing for Clayton Kershaw, who is participating in his first World Series. Probably
now he gets a little nervous, right?
He does. He's had some trouble in the postseason, but he got through the playoffs, which is usually where he got hung up. And, you know, he is one of the best pitchers
of our generation, of this time. Like, to me, I think that's something, that's a storyline to root for.
Another storyline to look at is, of course, you're playing the Houston Astros.
Look at what the city of Houston's been through.
As Dodger fans across the country, you suddenly become the bad guy in this series when you think about it. Because you're the Dodgers, you're the organization has won. Houston, look what that city's been through. Look how special and amazing it would be if Houston won. Think about back when Katrina hit and the Saints won the Super Bowl.
The next year, everybody was rooting for New Orleans. Okay, so if you don't have a dog in the race and you just don't care, most people are going to be rooting for Houston. Mm-hmm. Be Houston strong. We got to bring it back.
If it had been the Yankees, everyone could say, okay, that's the evil empire. It's New York. It's L.A. versus New York. This is our chance.
So the entire nation is against the Dodgers.
Except for Dodgers fans. I mean, if you're not a Dodgers fan and you're not a Houston fan and you're rooting for the Dodgers, then you're essentially rooting for another hurricane to hit Houston.
I don't know. I think that's a little too much. You don't want that. But look, you want Houston. A lot of people are saying, look, this would be great for the city of Houston for them to bounce back. And so most of the rest of the country is going to root for Houston.
I think it's a better series because all year long, Houston was the runaway sort of favorite. Cleveland had a great run in the second half, but it was Houston most of the year in the American League. And then Los Angeles, most of that first half of the year, they were just unbeatable. They kind of hit a little bit of a dark patch like in August, picked it back up in September, and it goes to show that it doesn't really matter how you play. Once the playoff comes, blank slate.
So what do the Dodgers need to look out for when it comes to playing the Astros?
Houston is young, and they have a lot of great hitters.
Great hitters.
Jose Altuve is the second baseman, 5'6". He's like a Mighty Mouse type guy, but he is an unbelievable hitter.
Hits for power.
Yeah.
Even though he's so small, he hits for power.
Carlos Correa, Springer. They have great hitters, Houston. And then they've got an old guy who joined their pitching staff down the stretch, Justin Verlander, one of the best pitchers in the league.
Some people might know him as Kate Upton's husband.
Oh.
He is a player who played for Detroit for many years, threw about 100 miles an hour. He's
a great pitcher. He is having the most unbelievable postseason. I think he's 4-0. His ERA, I believe, is under 2. He's really having an unbelievable postseason. He's kind of the spiritual leader and the veteran for this Houston team. And so, you know, Dodgers haven't been in a World Series, I believe, since 88. They haven't won since 88. So this is really exciting. And Houston was in the mid-2000s. But you've got two great teams going at it. I think this series probably goes 7 games. That's my prediction.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting.
It should be a very exciting World Series.
Okay, talk a little bit about this designated hitter business because the American League has a designated hitter.
Correct.
The National League
does not.
Which the Dodgers belongs.
The pitchers hit in the National League.
Right.
So when we're playing the World Series in American League ballpark in Houston, then there will be a designated hitter. When we're in Los Angeles, then there will not be a designated hitter. Some people say, well, that's an advantage for the Dodgers because Dodgers pitchers, Clayton Kershaw is a decent
hitter. He's actually a really good hitter.
So they've had a lot of experience hitting against pitching, and Houston not so much in recent years. Although, don't forget, Houston was in the National League a few years ago. So they switched over to the American League more recently.
A lot of these players
have played in both leagues.
So the pitchers have hit in their career.
It's not going to be a huge factor.
It's not like a guy's never picked up a bat. And then when you think about the American League, they played with the designated hitter all year long. So they actually know how to use it strategically, maybe better than a National League team, which has.
And guys who are designated hitters are guys who are not playing in the field, who are only hitting, and their focus is hitting, and they're used to that. You know, it's a little bit of a different game. Some players, you know, especially in the National League, you want to be playing in the field to keep your mind going and to stay in the game, not just for your 3 or 4 at bats in the game.
So they may have an advantage. So what do you recommend for fans who are going to be sitting in the stadium tomorrow night at 5? And like
if
I said,
you are down the right,
you're going to be roasting.
If you are down the right field line, put on as much sunscreen as you can.
Hydrate a lot. Save your beer for the 3rd or 4th inning.
That's right. It is going to be, as soon as the sun goes down kind of behind the stadium,
you're going to be fine.
But it is going to be 100 degrees and it is going to be hot. It is just, we've sat there for playoff games around this time of year in the right field.
And you roast.
Or maybe just go to a bar and
you just roast.
TV.
Yeah. Or like most people, because of that giant circle of hell, that's what I will call the parking lot at Chavez Ravine. You will get there before the game, but you will not park until the 3rd inning, so you should be fine.
Just stay in your
right?
car.
Just
for
let the
whole
parking
game.
Lot sort it out.
Yes.
Is what we have to say. It's going to be a great series. And for LA, you know, again, Dodgers are in the World Series. This is something that we haven't said for decades. It's very exciting.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Randy, Jason, Sklar. They're part of the comedy team, the Sklar Brothers. Catch their podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Hey, Christian.
Hey there. Well,
quick
if you don't
feedback.
Have tickets yet for the Dodgers, how much would you be willing to pay? I put up a little Twitter poll about that. We've got more than 100 people who have voted so far, but 44% of them say, nothing. I'm not going to pay for that because I don't care about the World Series. 49% have said they would pay as much as $500, 5% up to $5,000, and 2% $5,000 to $100,000. Tickets are going very expensive,
though. I
want to
know who that 2%
is. Okay. $888 for just standing room only was the latest I saw.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Christian Bordahl, thank you so much. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.